again, Ebony Spectrum, here every Wednesday, 6 to 7, EST, since we're intergalactic, we got to put the actual hour on because there are time zones so that people get straight. I have in the studio Dr. DeMarcus.
DeMarcus.
Because, you know, I could put a French twist on it. I looked
you
at
can,
that.
And
I
you
said,
can.
Okay, DeMarquis Clark. But Dr. DeMarcus Clark is here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he's doing some interesting things that I think on a regular kind of rotation or however you want to put it, we're going to take a look at perhaps talking about some issues that hit you where you live. I mean, your background, I'm not going to read it. I'm going to ask you to talk about how you got to where you have gone in terms of University of Southern Mississippi and Syracuse University and the subject area that you've gotten into. And, of course, you are currently at Seton Hill University.
I am.
All right. A program director and associate professor. Dr. Clark, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. So I am from Jackson, Mississippi.
Okay.
I went to Tougaloo College. Okay. It is a historically black college in Jackson, Mississippi. I went there and I got my undergraduate degree in psychology. And then I went on to the University of Southern Mississippi to get my master's degree in marriage and family therapy. I wanted to get into therapy and counseling because my family, everything all right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Just keep going.
Okay.
Hi, Paige.
My father was an alcoholic. And what was happening wasn't just impacting him. His alcoholism was impacting me and my mom and the entire family. Mm-hmm. So I kept saying to myself, this is something that I need to figure out what it's about. How can one person's actions and what they're doing impact everybody? So I did some research and found out about this field of study called marriage and family therapy. Okay. And where they look at relationships and relational dynamics. Mm-hmm. And they had a program at University of Southern Mississippi, which is in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Okay. And then I said, I just wanted to keep going. You know, I said, if I stopped, I would not get my PhD. So I just kept going. I went to
Smart.
I went to Syracuse University. And at the time, I would say that Syracuse was the leading MFT program in the country, primarily because they focused on issues of social justice, mm-hmm. as well as self of the therapist work. So self of the therapist work is this idea that the greatest intervention that therapists have are themselves. So we need to make sure that we are right. We are attending to the ways in which we are wounded. So we can attend to that stuff. So when we're in the therapy room, we don't project our own woundedness and hurts onto our clients.
Okay.
I was at Syracuse. Then I left there, and went to Chicago, Illinois, and worked a lot around issues of trauma and abuse. So specifically sexual trauma and abuse. I ran a male survivor group for 5 years while I was there. And then I came here to Pittsburgh. So,
and this was the low point of his life.
Right. Oh, no. No, actually not. Actually.
Okay, great. I know many of us many times think like, particularly if you come from the South,
Right.
You came from Florida to Pittsburgh? Why?
Right.
It'll ask you very straight.
Now, it did take me some time to adjust.
All right.
Because I kept comparing it to Chicago. Then I just had to start appreciating Pittsburgh for what Pittsburgh had to offer.
Right.
So I applied at the time Seton Hill. So Seton Hill is actually the only accredited MFT program, COAMPTI accredited MFT program in Western Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
And they had a position available for the center director. And so I applied there at the time just on a whim. Mm-hmm. Said, let me apply and see what happens.
Right.
So I applied, and I said, they're not going to offer me the position. They offered me the position. And I said, well, they're not going to give me the money that I want for the position. They did that.
Right.
So I said, okay, I'm moving to Pittsburgh.
Lo and behold.
Right. And I was able, me and the program director at the time, were able to create, the provost allowed us the ability to create a marriage and family therapy program in the way that we think therapists should be trained. And that was just like professionally a huge gift to me at the time.
Okay.
So then time passed. We did that. We centered the program on three core principles. And these are core principles that I just believe about people and relationships. One is on the centrality of relationships. So in the centrality of mental health. So it's the belief that mental health is central to relationships. So relationships are central to mental health care. We are who we are because of our relationships with ourselves, our partners, our families, our society. So relationships are everything. So I am constantly talking about relationships. The other core principle is around social justice, because we believe that we learn most and grow most when we are in relationship with people that are different from us. If we continue to stay around people that are similar to us, we stay stagnant in who we are and what we believe. And then secondly is what I was talking about earlier, this self of the therapist piece, that we are the greatest intervention walking into the therapy room, so we have to be grounded and clear in who we are and what we believe.
And it's the self of the therapist?
Self of the therapist.
Okay. That's interesting. A couple, many, many things have gone through my mind in a number of things that you presented. The centrality of relationships. My first love is being an organizer.
Okay.
You may have figured that out. And, you know, some say rabble rouser, whatever. But one of the things that always amazed me were when people would over assert their individuality. And then I would find myself like doing a little, I don't know what kind of discipline it would come from, but saying, well, first of all, you came from the union of a man and woman. So it ain't no singular thing that you have done yourself. And then if you understand what society is and how we learn to talk and have language and customs, you can't do that by yourself either.
Right. That's right.
So we overplay this. I'm an individual and I made it. No, you didn't do that all by yourself.
Right.
You know, starting from the birth sequence.
And then we don't learn by ourselves. We learn by relationships, by watching relationships, by watching interactions. It's all about relationships.
I smiled when you said about, you said on your journey to get the PhD, not stop and go right through.
That's right.
My dad counseled me. I want you to go to college. Almost, I guess he said that now, and I've told it probably later in life, that he said, you will be going to college. You have to go. You will go. And not because he had gone. He got a little bit under his belt, you know, over time. But he didn't get, he wanted to be a journalist. Probably would have been one of the best, if not a publisher or something. Who knows?
All right.
But my test was to get to 4 years at least. He said, now, the graduate, you should go just what you did. You should get all of that. And so, no, I didn't do that, you know, hard hit. And so I go to community college where I'm at now, Community College of Allegheny County. And for a long time, I'm doing my thing in the community, and I'm not bothering them, and they're not bothering me. And one day it's like, we want you to go out and be assistant dean in charge of the Homer Preston Center. And I'm like, me? Okay. And they said, well, it's your community. You grew up there. You know the people. You work in the community. We think you'll be perfect. But you'll have to get this master's degree. We'll put you in there interim. But you can't be on this level with just a bachelor's degree. I'm like, okay. So then I did go get in business communication. But the first thing I did was call my dad. Started to tell him, I said, hold up, don't say nothing. Now, see if you listen to me. And I said it to him, and we both laughed. If you listen to me, you'd have had this out the way.
Right.
He gave me the whole spiel, like, look, you'll get out here, you'll get married, you'll have children, you start working, and you'll never get back to it.
Right.
So anyhow, I did, like around 50. You know, and I did it all online, which is an interesting experience. But the communications piece, and I realized all through my life, even doing like radio as a sideline, as an organizer, as somebody who's profoundly involved with interactions, personal, interpersonal interactions, I've been fascinated by the dilemma of communication, the same thing. I mean, relationship is communication. Communication is defined as you transmit a message, it's received, and you get feedback. So it's a loop. It's a relationship.
It's a relationship.
So
exactly.
And then I've been totally fascinated by how we all can be like the same ethnicity, around the same age, maybe work in the same kind of industry, have a conversation, walk away, think we got like simpatico, we're like on the one, and find out later, we didn't understand each other. He was saying something else and I was saying something else, but yet we left with the falsehood that we had communicated and we were on the same page. How we get things done in society is amazing when you consider, because I was just thinking when you said the centrality of relationships, well, your partner, your parent, your significant other, your spouse, just to really put it out there as I often do, make it a little crazy here. If they are in fact crazy, well, that kind of affects the relationship. I mean, if you have not figured out a way to connect with someone, then maybe you could argue there's no relationship. So what's the impact when significant, in particularly the leading individuals in a family, are not communicating? Well, if you're a child, how does that not affect you?
Oh, it absolutely. And we're always communicating. We communicate directly and indirectly. So when parents go into a home and they aren't communicating, they're teaching their children how to be in relationships with their siblings, with them, with their future partners. So we are always communicating, either directly or indirectly.
Is there really a functional family? You know, you hear about dysfunctional families.
Right, right. I think we're all crazy and messy, and relationships are complicated and hard. And so I think I would define functional families or relationships as those that are constantly working on it, those that are constantly striving to better understand themselves and the people that they're in relationship with.
Yeah, I've laughed at that concept of dysfunctional family.
Right.
One, I thought it was rather pejorative.
Oh, it's absolutely pejorative.
And putting values on people, you
right.
know. And I'm sure there's a whole story they can tell you about who they are, why they are, and how they're doing things.
And how that dysfunction serves them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if, for example, me and my mom, she is a bit much. I'm her only child. She can be overbearing and controlling. And some people identify our relationship as dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. But it serves her. There's a reason why she's doing it, and it serves the purpose of our relationship and how she learned how to grow up, how her mom parented her. Mm-hmm. So it is extremely pejorative and functions. It is. There's a reason why it's happening.
Right. I've said often, you know, functional. All families are dysfunctional.
That's
at least
right.
have a degree of dysfunction.
That's right.
I mean, if
I
you're looking for a
agree.
Textbook nuclear family, that's why my name is Richard. You can call me Rick. Few people have called me Ricky, especially people that know me. And I think maybe there's a trend toward maybe female more than males, right?
Mm.
But there's two things you cannot call me. Richie and Dick. Those two are like, that's not my name. And with Dick, I'm convinced part of it is that reader. When I was in elementary school, Dick and Jane, C-Spot Run. And I didn't realize it at the time why that family or why parts of why that didn't reverberate with
right,
me.
Right.
Was this middle-class white family with this little dog and this little cat.
Right.
And Dick and Jane and Spot. Mm-hmm. That was like, what
right,
is this?
Right,
but for
right.
a couple of years, that was the reader that we had to deal with. So, yeah, first time I encountered that, it was like, no, that is not my name.
No,
I even embarrassed my dad one time on that because I'm a junior.
Okay.
And with his boss and maybe bosses at the Urban Redevelopment Authority, we went to some meeting. Oh, so you're Dick Jr. No, I'm Richard M. Adams Jr. My dad kind of looked like, all right, son, be cool.
right. Wow.
But, yeah, those issues of identity, how you fit. Now, I'm the firstborn, and I know two strong person. My mom's a real strong person. I guess I'm fairly strong myself. And we would fall out, especially around religion and some other things. We now have, like, detente. We know not to go too far and talk about certain things.
Right.
But I got to the point I characterized it as the king and queen discussion. And I was like, well, I want to be the king. and you are the queen, and you're not my wife, so I got to go. Well, you don't have to go. You know, you just had to follow the rules. No, I want to be the king. I don't want to follow the rules. I want to make the rules.
Some clear boundaries are
right,
being set
right.
up.
I have to leave the nest.
This right.
Like, you know, I can't control myself, whatever you want to call it. So making those decisions and evolving, it's a challenge for everyone. And one of the first papers I did in my undergrad, Monahan was alive, that whole thing about the disintegration of the black family. Or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I remember one of the first papers I wrote was something like the black family, a protean. I didn't even know what that word meant, but a flexible model of, I forgot how I ended it.
Mm-hmm.
But I made this whole argument about how we still had an extended family and how we looked out for each mm-hmm. other. And we had either folks who actually were related to us or weren't related to us, who we referred to as uncle and aunt and, you know, cousins.
Right.
And for all functional purposes, we are. In fact, I just had a situation where me and a cousin sit on a board. And I almost asked him when we did the conflict of interest, because this, you shouldn't be related. Well, we're not really by, you know, so I'm like,
right.
Although I believe we are. So, you know, it was a kind of interesting question to even consider that in terms of the nature of family. You know,
right.
Well, now, is that a conflict of interest or what? Because, yeah, I mean, if he says, come over, these people are trying to hurt me, I'll be right there. You know, like
right.
Family. No.
Right. So as you're talking about that, I'm thinking about how when I grew up, it was something similar.
Mm-hmm.
But when I moved north, it felt like the philosophy around that had shifted and changed.
Mm-hmm.
So I always equated that to Southern culture, Southern mm-hmm. black culture versus Northern black culture.
Right, right.
But maybe it's about, so when you talk about, I think what I thought about was maybe it's about time. And back then, this was like 25, 30 years ago, I'm talking about, to now maybe right. just, maybe it's about time being different. And not different in Northern and Southern culture.
Right. Well,
does that make sense?
Absolutely. Most besides all of us, ancestors coming from Africa,
mm-hmm.
many cases, there were only a couple of points. So I've been known to say on occasion, we all came at least through Virginia
right.
on our way
at some point. Right.
On our way to
right.
other places.
That's right.
But also, the biggest difference I always thought was and we talked about it in our family. Mom's side, my grandfather out of Alabama, and my grandmother out of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
But the relationship to the land, I think, makes a very profound difference, where this urban kind of living, folks didn't always get, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, we wanted to get a house, but it was also at first about getting up here where there was a good paying job. So then the settlement movement, and
mm-hmm.
My family did like immigrants do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Pop-up came up. He waited till he could send for his bride, my grandmother, his brother, Uncle So-and-so came. You know, they came up mm-hmm. and basically for a while stayed in the house, the beachhead
right.
that we had established here, until you could branch out. So that kind of extended family thing, I think – there's a lot of pointing of fingers mm-hmm. that if you don't really look at that history, because they'll say now, well, why don't you do like, you know, take your pick, the Asians, or they'll name a group. And I always tell people, I said, well, the first big thing is we did that over 100 years ago when we came off the plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And we have one of the greatest records, if not the number one record still standing for gaining literacy, starting colleges, getting jobs and doing things coming out of that kind of situation,
mm-hmm.
bar any people's experience. So now we're like everybody else, middle-class Americans. Whether they got money or not, everybody middle-class and capitalist.
Right.
Even though we have no capital and the wages aren't what they should be. But but that's the philosophy.
Right.
So no more than the next European American or anybody else. No, we're not going to get 10 of us in a room and be living. And yeah, I'd like to have a car, you know. So that kind of doing without fit us as really an agrarian peasant in the 1800s, 1865, 66, 67, except for the folks who had skills. You know, if you were a blacksmith or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows at one point in the early part of the 20th century that I think it was like 60% of all the patents came from black people. And you say, wow, how'd that happen? Well, if you got an iron shirt, you're going to invent an ironing board. Mm-hmm. You know, if you got to do the work, you're going to figure out how to come up with something that makes it easier. You know, if I got to pick cotton, well, I'm going to figure out how to do it the least painful and the most efficient way I can do it.
Absolutely.
And so a lot of things that were just everyday kind of things, we had to navigate, work with, accomplish, and do. So we invented.
That makes sense to me.
So I don't know. Maybe we're a little bit off the topic. I'm not sure. We're talking with Dr. DeMarcus Clark, and he's at Seton Hill University, Program Director and Associate Professor in the Marriage and Family Therapy Program. And you mentioned Jackson is home.
Jackson is home.
I have never been there, but I have all these, I feel all these connections to Jackson.
Really?
The mayor, the late mayor, Chokwe Lumumba.
Mm-hmm.
I have a special moment, and he wouldn't even know. I've spoken to him. I had spoke to him. He wouldn't know me, but I felt like I knew him. And one is because we were all 10,000 of us in Gary, Indiana, in 1972 for the National Black Political Convention.
Okay.
And at one point, it looked like the convention was going to get derailed, and we weren't going to get done what we thought, at least the militant progressive group that had a real clear thing about building an independent political structure, that if we didn't get this agenda passed and do it in there, not send it back to the states, that we had enough I mean, we had everybody who was anybody was there. We'll talk about that later. But it looked like we were going to lose this vote, and they were pushing to table it. And Chokwe got up and made this speech. And I always remember something along the lines of, it is long past the time that any individual or group can hold back the black nation.
Hmm.
And all of us start chanting, you know, it's nation time, it's nation time, move the vote, move the vote. I had never been to a black city. I certainly hadn't been to a high school that could hold 10,000 people in it. You know, so I was just totally like blown away.
Right, right.
We even were allowed to register in City Hall, which I laughed. You could probably figure this part of it out. Having come fairly recent to Pittsburgh, you see how Pittsburgh is now, and you see how other cities, Chicago.
Right.
The notion of us for the National Black Political Convention signing into something in City Hall in Pittsburgh, that wasn't going to happen. You know, so I was just totally in awe of this whole experience. So anyhow,
right.
Chokwe Lumumba and his, of course, movement down there. But even before that, Republic of New Africa, mm-hmm. very involved there. And, this is terrible. The mind is a terrible thing to waste. The two brothers, Mario Bedelli, and what was his brother's name? There were two of them that were very much involved in the movement there. So in a lot of ways, you know, I feel there's always something special around Jackson. And then there was a famous shooting, too, during the 60s.
Yeah, at Jackson State University.
Yeah, yeah, that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were a lot of ways why I was paying attention and knowing of Jackson. So that was interesting to me from that kind of standpoint, you know. And then Tougaloo, that's right. Emma Lou Holloway, I'm sure she's probably, well, I guess she's, I'm not sure. You know, you think when you're young, you have this impression. And
right.
I had to apologize to my parents. I told them one day, I said, you know, I got to thinking and really counting back and looking at it. When I thought you were like kind of like unhip and didn't know what was going on, I figured out. At first I was saying 50. When I really looked at it, I was like, that was probably in their 40s. And I certainly do not think that is old.
Right.
You know, right. Particularly at the age I am now. So I'm like, wow. So it changes your perspective. So I'm not sure how old, but she was appeared to be an older woman.
Okay.
But she taught history, but she was from Tougaloo University.
Hmm.
Yeah, Dr. Emma Holloway.
Yeah, Tougaloo has a special place in my heart. I mean,
I'll have to go down there and get over my, you know, for a number of years, I wasn't going nowhere near that in the 60s. I was like, oh, no.
Yeah. Tougaloo was such a refuge for black activism in the South, in Mississippi. And then they've produced so many African-American attorneys and doctors in Mississippi.
Right, right.
It just it holds such a special place in my heart.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's special to the nation and to our people. For
yes,
sure.
I agree.
For sure. So.
And so far, Pittsburgh has been good to me.
Okay.
So I am making Pittsburgh home.
All right.
So, yeah, Pittsburgh has been pretty good to me.
Pittsburgh, I never tire. Being native here, so
right.
I feel like, well, I have to speak up for my city and explain right. it as best I can. I mean, some of this is as crazy as I think it is elsewhere, too. Pittsburgh is, I call it the largest hick town in America.
I get that.
I said, now, on one hand, I mean, we're not the smallest. We used to be a lot bigger, 640,000, I think, in the 1960s, top of that decade. Now we're like 320,000 in municipal Pittsburgh. But a city this size has a pro football team, a pro baseball team, a hockey team, a symphony, has all these colleges. I mean, you start looking at the stuff that's here, it's like, what? Well, then you start realizing you study the history, the gateway to the West at one point, fighting the savages at this point. And I'm saying that, don't call up and get on me. You know, I'm using pejorative type language. I believe my great grandmother is Native American. That's what I'm told. And she appears to be that in a picture I've seen. So, anyway, I'm certainly not casting any shade, is it, they say these days, on them. But. Again, back to the labor movement started in Pittsburgh. The Industrial Revolution kind of started in Pittsburgh. The fact that the melons were here. So you start to realize the importance of the city. And then you start personalizing. Well, what is the experience for the black people here? Man, the city's rough. It's tough. You know, it's hard to get through. Okay, that's a whole thing, and we'll never tire of bringing that up as we fight to make it what it should be.
Right.
But I always point out, it is tight for white folk, too. If it wasn't for unions and the Eastern Europeans organizing themselves, that small robber baron group that controlled everything, and to this day still controls everything, if you run afoul of them, then you better have a special skill, like you cut hair or you're a dentist or something, where you can go somewhere and kind of do it on your own. But if you're going to rely on them to open doors, you're going to be in trouble in this city.
Yeah,
I get the impression, Chicago, there are several different significant poles of power, even within the black community.
Yes.
And there's some of that in Pittsburgh, but basically we're almost kind of down to one and one. You know, it's not all of this diversity, to use it in another kind of way, that term. Which has always kind of fascinated me, how this works.
Pittsburgh has been the first metropolitan area that I've moved to that was not more diverse than it is. It definitely lacks diversity.
It's black and white.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But it is absolute, I feel, beyond blessed. So I am the program director at the Imagine Family Therapy Program at Seton Hill, but I also have my own private practice where I work with individuals, couples, and families. And Pittsburgh has supported me, and they have come in, and they've supported me. And so I was able to start the Center for Relational Change, which is a group practice of clinicians seeing individuals, couples, families doing group work. And again, Pittsburgh is supporting us. So in so many ways, I struggle with many things of Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh is absolutely supporting me, and I am beyond blessed about that.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I got to say, I feel we're blessed.
Absolutely.
I'm glad you're here, and I always fret when people leave. I'm like, oh, we're losing everybody. Don't leave. But it's hard to argue the other because, there's some, and there's more. I mean, probably one of the most surprising things to me in this city was when I looked around and the president of the community college was African-American. Now we're on our second. The coach of the Steelers was African-American.
Yep.
And the president of the doggone United States. I was like, wait a minute. This must
That's too much.
Yeah, this must be the end
of
time.
Going on.
Yeah, this must be the end of time.
Right.
And particularly the whole Pittsburgh piece. And then there was a point, and I forget now how many there are, but the state schools all had these black presidents.
Wow.
in this, I mean, we were fighting for stuff like that, but in the 60s, 70s, and 50s yeah. back, before I really got into it, but you never would have thunk it. Yeah, right. Detroit, yeah, Chicago, yeah, New right. York, you yes. know, Newark, New Jersey, you would have thought of it there, Atlanta. Right. Pittsburgh, I often share with people, we had another newspaper, the Pittsburgh Press.
Hmm.
It had a magazine, which I think was kind of national or regional. And it was Roto, R-O-T-O, Roto Magazine,
okay.
being the Sunday paper. And so one Sunday, I'm reading the Roto Magazine, and it lists cities expected to become majority black. Okay, so they named the cities that we just mentioned. Pittsburgh was on that list.
Was it?
So I'm like, wow, okay. Well, I'll just put it on the city fathers and stop there. Some folks sat down and said, oh, no, it's not. And when I look at housing patterns and where people kind of were directed to move through various means, rent, what they call it, rent steering and mm-hmm. redlining and mm-hmm. availability of credit and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And then you just look, east of the city is Wilkinsburg Borough.
Mm-hmm.
There's Penn Hills. There's Monroeville. If all those people there were in the city, it would be a majority black city today.
I agree.
And so
I agree.
Emanating from where I grew up, Homewood Brushing in the east, it would be natural to go Point Breeze, Squirrel Hill, Stanton Heights, Howland Park, Oakland, the upper part by the university and all of that. And then once you do that, you connect to the Hill District and you go across the river. All the way out east is East Hills, right on the fringe of Penn Hills and Wilkinsburg.
Okay.
You would have had a black belt all the way through the city of Pittsburgh to the north side. And if that had been allowed to happen naturally, like I think it would have, people moving to slightly better house around an area they do like, but they, you know, they want to move and improve their lives as opposed to necessarily. Now, some did it and wanted to get as far as they could or whatever.
Right.
But there would be a lot of folk who would be in the city today. So that has always fascinated me how that was engineered.
Yeah. You
know, now they're trying to engineer it back because they'd studied all these cities and said, fastest growing cities are all very diverse, way more diverse. They got Mexicans and Latinos and Asian folk.
Yeah.
And we're lacking. And yeah. you're right. For those groups to be like 1%. I don't think it's at 1% yet. It's getting there. It's just, and that's why I had experience I had when I went north to school. And went to New York City. Number one, people looked at us real strange because we were acting like we were from the country because we had been starved in Brunswick, Maine. So we were, and at that point, I understand it may be a little bit different now, but New Yorkers didn't even speak to people on the street. So here we come. Hey, what's up, brother? Right. Yo, yo. Not only did they not answer, they didn't even look at it. They just kept on about their business.
Right.
Wow. But what really struck me is when I heard people talk or did get an opportunity to say something to folks, all these brothers speaking French and Portuguese. I'm looking at them like, where are they from? You know, somebody with a British accents and all.
Yeah.
And I had to tell my number of people who were from New York, I said, we don't have this in Pittsburgh.
Right.
And they got the Dominicans and the Jamaicans. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Said, we have none of these back home.
Pittsburgh has a ways to go.
Yep,
a
definitely. Ways to go. Definitely.
Yeah.
So this center that you have at the Seton Hill and then the private practice. And I did go a little bit. I didn't get to spend as much time on the private practice piece.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't realize that that was wholly your enterprise, the genesis of it, which is like, congratulations. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
And what we'll have to talk. We'll have many shows to talk. we'll plot out.
I am hoping.
We'll plot out when and where. And, of course, there will always be things in the news.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Most of the time, unfortunately, that we could begin to talk about
because
something bad that has happened. But also, I would like to share some contacts, and we don't have to do it even on the air, but I chair the board of the Institute of the Black World, 21st Century, and Dr. Ron Daniels is the founder and president of New York. But we have worked to put together a Black Family Summit. And so we have the Black psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, MDs, nurses, EMT, EMS folk, law enforcement, mm-hmm. and we have been trying to say all of you trained, certified professionals have a special role vis-a-vis our community. Mm-hmm. We even got down to FEMA, I guess it's 2 years now, to sign an agreement that they would contact through the Institute of the Black World these organizations. Mm-hmm. And we had started working Katrina and then Sandy when that hit New York.
Right.
And so these folks in these different professions were doing things on their own and as individuals and in small groupings. I remember some of the brothers and sisters talking about Sandy, and 2-3 weeks after it was off the front pages, that there were black and poor people out in Long Island who were without electricity and everything, and nobody was paying them any attention.
Right.
So it was an interesting kind of niche, and I'm excited where that kind of collaboration might be able to go. So
all right. I just wanted to note that I didn't hear, maybe it's LMFT on there, but I did not hear licensed marriage and family therapist.
I would not be surprised if there is, but okay. I don't recall anybody presenting themselves that way.
Because,
we had a little joke off the air about when I saw LMFT.
Right.
Like, what is
right,
that?
What is that? Right, right.
So that's my ignorance. But the issues, I know they're working on a emancipation healing circles.
Hmm.
And there's been an awful lot of talk, including the Institute of the Black World, about the level of trauma that is in our community.
Oh, absolutely.
From domestic abuse to obviously the shootings.
Yes.
And how that's like a war type of situation, that there are a lot of people that need help. Drug abuse is a public health hazard. It's
absolutely.
Not something to lock people up. They should be getting treatment.
That's right. That's right.
When I looked at the issues, poverty, as you listed here, impact of violence, drugs and alcohol, sexual issues, parent-child issues. We, people around the Black Family Summit, wrote up a definition, and it's real specific. I know I'm going to get this wrong. But it basically dealt with defining how adoption should be handled and the social, cultural implications of non-group, I guess, mm-hmm. adoption. Made some kind of definition of what the impact of that was. So all of these things about children, blended families, marriage, the social workers got a strong program in terms of Afrocentric kind of values
mm-hmm.
that they've
mm-hmm.
brought to their clinical piece.
Mm-hmm.
So that just excites me because there's so much that needs to be done. You can see it.
Absolutely.
You can almost be blind and deaf and see it in our community.
Yeah.
Because not to heap everything on black folk, which goes on too much in this society. It's not just black folk. And certainly it's other people of color. But it's also the way we treat. If you're in poverty and poor, we make that like a personal shortcoming.
Yes.
Like there's something wrong with you.
Yes.
Not that, some people at the top got a whole bunch of money and then most of us got much less.
Right.
That's more the problem.
Yes.
Than it's like, you were born with certain traits, so you're destined to be poor. No.
Yes. Poverty is an epidemic that we have to address and have to attend to because it impacts everything that we do.
Right.
We have to address that.
As an educator, that, I'm not going to call the numbers right, but it's something like low income and children of color have like a 20,000 word vocabulary. And other middle-class children come with 100,000 or something. It's like such a wide disparity. It's like, that would kind of hamper you.
That's right.
You can't read. You don't have an ability to look at those, what do I want to call them, those concepts that are not abstruse, but and not vague, although that's how it'll seem sometimes, not physical. The word is escaping, I really want. But that's a level of thinking you need to be able to get on. And to also honor the level of thinking our children, our people do have that comes through a different kind of cultural filter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you measure somebody and you look at this bottle and you say, describe this bottle. And perhaps somebody might say, it's like purple. It's plastic. And somebody else rolls along and says, well, it's about 7 inches tall, and it has a circumference.
Right. But and it can contain so many ounces.
Yeah, that's not right. A measure of intelligence. Right. That's like training people to mm-hmm. know how to, how we commonly have exchanged information mm-hmm. and on a different level, not and even necessarily a higher level.
Access to information.
Just like we go to a concert.
That's right.
You and I go to a concert, or maybe you go and I don't go. And I say, well, how was the concert? And you say it was bad. You might say a few more things.
Mm-hmm.
That's different than saying, well, there were 10,000 people there.
That's right.
He was on a Yamaha mm-hmm. organ.
Absolutely.
Now, one might look at the conversation and say, well, see, they're of lower intelligence. No. It's mm-hmm. just a different way. That wasn't important right. to the experience. And if you really dwell down, and we both agreed, we both were there, it was bad. Yeah, it was bad. Well, if we dwell down, yeah, we probably do have slightly different reasons why we think it was bad, but mm-hmm. we understand what we're saying.
Right.
And that we both liked the concert.
Yes.
You know, bottom line. So all of those kind of challenges in terms of how we enable people to navigate
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
through society and through, back to your original premise, relationships.
That's right.
Is a skill that has to be learned. It doesn't come to you naturally.
No, I completely agree. And I'm hoping that monthly we can have complicated conversations about all the stuff, all these topics that I would
right.
love to talk about.
Yeah, this is just introductory conversation, yes. as I told you.
Yes, absolutely.
And like I said, I like to just sit down and kick it.
Yes.
And I do think, particularly still too often, African Americans don't get a chance to have this kind of stuff broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
And then those who have access all too often fail us. You know, we get too much of, you are not the father. Now, come on. Mm-hmm. How many shows do right. we need to have like
right.
that? And let's talk about what does it mean to be a father?
Mm-hmm.
How to be a better father?
Right. You know? And what are the purpose of those shows?
Exactly. Right. And if, which is a trend of modern, you know, it's not like it used to be where nobody hardly ever got divorced. And, you know, it's a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it started out when probably most of the marriages were like you were 13, 14, 15. And many of you were dead by 30.
Yes.
Now people live in 80, 90
right.
years. So now you got to consider, well, is that too long to, you know, live with somebody? You know, okay,
mm-hmm.
I can do the 20, but no, the 30th year. So there's some interesting things that, in my mind, aren't right and wrong. Let's talk about these things.
Exactly. I think there are monogamous relationships. There are polyamorous relationships. It's about having a complicated understanding of these things
right.
without judgment.
And now the whole thing around, I haven't had this experience yet, and I guess I'm looking forward to it, but I know it's going to be rough. The whole gender identity piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard about the meetings where you go around and everyone says their like pronoun
mm-hmm.
preference,
mm-hmm.
which I'm like, wow, that must be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The only experience kind of like that, and it was interesting, my reaction after a while, was the Black Radical Congress in Chicago had their, that might have been their first meeting, one of their first. But anyway, the men couldn't talk, only the women could talk.
Mm-hmm.
And we could not talk till they were finished talking. So I was all right with that for about an hour. And then I wanted to join in. I'm like, well, what? We haven't heard all the women yet. They haven't relinquished the floor. Okay, I understand. We hog, we talk over. I know how we men are. I'm guilty as anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I get real passionate, and I'm talking loud. Be like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
And a lot of times the female's trying to be, you know, polite. Excuse me, my turn. We're all over them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes many times we're not even aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
But to start to break down those kind of things, just because you could talk louder to somebody, that doesn't give you the right to hog the floor.
Right, not just that, but we've been conditioned to believe that our voices are the ones that matter. That when we speak up, that means that we are leaders and alphas and
right.
blah, 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 blah,
right.
blah. And we place a greater value on that. And women are conditioned to not speak up. And if you do speak up, then you are
the B word.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
But yes, I am excited to have all of those conversations.
You're not aggressive. You're
that's right.
Yeah, there's so much to explore. So much of what we take as gospel is like arbitrary.
That's right.